My guest Tom Friedman won two Pulitzer Prizes during his years covering the Middle East. Friedman's new book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, is about his journey between these two worlds and how he understood the events and the people he met along the way. He writes, on one level, this book is about a young man from Minnesota who goes to Beirut and confronts a world for which nothing in his life had ever prepared him. On another level, it's about a Jew who was raised on all the stories, all the folk songs, and all the myths about Israel, who goes to Jerusalem in the 1980s and discovers that it isn't the Jewish summer camp of his youth, but rather an audacious and still unresolved experiment to get Jews to live together in one country in the midst of the Arab world. Friedman was UPI's Beirut correspondent from 1979 to 81. Then he joined the New York Times, for which he covered Lebanon until 1984. From Lebanon, he went to Israel, where he was the Times' first Jewish Jerusalem bureau chief. This year, he moved to Washington, D.C. to cover the State Department and foreign affairs for the Times. When the Times sent Friedman to Jerusalem, they dispensed with their own unwritten rule that Jews shouldn't cover Israel.
Well, I think they realized that in this day and age, it was an anachronism. It was an anachronism in any day and age. But I think they realized that some of the insecurities that maybe the paper felt about being perceived as an overly Jewish newspaper and somehow wouldn't be able to report objectively from the Middle East, that it had overcome that. And given the fact that I had been in Beirut for 4 years and had reported in a way which was recognized by many people as fair and objective, I think they felt very comfortable sending me to Jerusalem.
I think one of the stories you became very emotionally involved with was in 1982, the massacre at the Sabra and Shatila refugee camps. You described that as a personal crisis for you.
Well, it was, Terry, because for me it was, I was the only Jew in West Beirut at the time. The Israeli army was surrounding the city, and even though the Israelis were only indirectly involved in the massacre at Sabra and Shatila, it was profoundly disturbing to me. I felt that was not how the Jewish state I had grown to know and love as a young boy should be behaving. And when I went to interview the Israeli commander after Sabra and Shatila, we basically got into a most unobjective shouting match. Actually, it wasn't a match. I was doing the shouting. He was doing the listening, in which I basically said to him, how could you do this? How could you do this to us? How could you do this to me?
In 1982, your father-in-law was told by one of his business associates who lived in New York, that you had become the most unpopular man in all of New York City because of your reporting from Beirut. Did you feel like people wanted to kill the messenger?
Oh, definitely. I mean, even more than Son of Sam, I was told that I was the most hated man. It was most hated man in New York City. Definitely. I mean, part of my whole book, I mean, is part of the dynamic of it is that I am both the messenger and the object of the message. I am both experiencing new sights and sounds and feelings and things both ugly and beautiful for the first time and conveying those to my readers in America. And at the same time, I'm a subject of those, and I'm personally being changed by what I see in Beirut and what I see in Jerusalem. And in reflecting that, in some way, so are my readers. That change was very painful for some people who had certain mythical images of either the Israelis or the Palestinians. And hence, there were some people who wanted to, I'd like to say, stifle the messenger, not kill the messenger.
Mm-hmm. My guest is journalist Tom Friedman, and his new book, From Beirut to Jerusalem, is about the years from 1979 to 1988, when he covered the Middle East, mostly for the New York Times, and he won two Pulitzer Prizes during those years. You say that you came to think of Beirut as the darkest corner of human behavior, a place where people talk about violence like they talk about the weather. What do you mean by that?
Well, Beirut was it was a jungle. It was a jungle in which not even the law of the jungle applied. The most frightening thing, I think, about living in Beirut was that nobody was keeping score. Mm-hmm. You could suffer, and you could suffer some more, and you could suffer still some more. There was nobody keeping score. I once covered a story in Beirut. An apartment building had been blown up, and a woman had come back to the apartment after it had been blown up and saw it, this pile of rubble, and her family was trapped inside. And a dramatic photograph was taken of her being held back by one arm as she reached out with her other, wanting to fling herself onto the rubble. And I covered the story in that scene. And a half an hour later, a car bomb went off about two blocks away from this building, and that lady was blown up. And it always reminded me that in Beirut, nobody was keeping score. It was a city without echoes. Nobody's life reverberated in its ear. You always felt that 5 minutes after you died, your tombstone would be carved up and be used as a sidewalk or someone's doorstep.
Why wasn't anybody keeping score? Because violence had become so common, because the authorities didn't care?
Yeah, I mean, after 14 years of sustained violence and killing, nobody's life really seems to matter anymore. Dying there is like diving into a pool of water and not leaving any ripple on the surface. Some people like to think that someone's keeping score. I had a Lebanese friend who used to tell me that every time she flew on a plane, she carried a bomb with her because the odds of two people carrying a bomb on the plane were much less than one. So people like to think that someone was keeping score, and people wanted to impose a certain rationality on it. That's why when someone would get killed, people always had an explanation. You know, if the shell landed across the street and blew up your neighbor, well, you would say, well, of course, he lived on the wrong side of the street, or he shouldn't have gone out 15 minutes after the shelling. He should have waited 20. Everyone knows that. In other words, people tried to impose a certain order and rationality on the violence, because otherwise they would be paralyzed. People couldn't accept the fact that the only reason they were alive and their neighbor not was callous fate.
Well, this came very close to you. The house you were living in was blown up. Would you tell that story?
Well, basically, in the first week of the Israeli invasion, as the Israelis tightened their siege around West Beirut, refugees fled from the outskirts of the city into the inner city where I lived and began occupying vacant apartments. And we lived in a very nice apartment house on the Mediterranean, and several of the tenants had been away for the summer, and their apartments were broken into by various Palestinian clans who were looking to find refuge. And basically, they tried to take over our apartment. They were dissuaded from doing so by my assistant, who is a Palestinian. And we decided that I would move into a hotel, and my assistant would put his two daughters into the apartment. So if anyone came and asked for it, they would say, look, we're just Palestinian refugees, too, and we've got the apartment. Unfortunately, other refugees in the building got in a fight over who would get some other apartments, and the group that lost simply went out and bought some dynamite and blew up the whole building with my driver's wife and two daughters, tragically, in my apartment.
You said everybody comes up with a rationale when violence hits their family. Did you find that happened when this apartment was blown up and your friend's family was in it?
No, you know, that was one that I had no rationale for. I realized that it was simply callous fate that I wasn't in the apartment. I had been there earlier in the day. The bomb could have gone off at any time. I just happened not to be around.
It's not easy to cover a civil war. So you found, I think, all kinds of interesting ways to sense what was happening. For instance, you say that your best political analysis was a guy who sold window glass. This is an interesting way of finding out what the climate was like.
Well, that was my friend Riyadh, and anytime I wanted to know what the mood on the street was, I went to Riyadh, because when his window glass business was good, when people were buying windows, it meant they had confidence in the political situation that there was going to be a period of stability and no one was going to be shooting out or shelling out their windows. When people were disturbed or fearful about the impending political situation, Riyadh's business went south, and no one was buying windows. No one was replacing their broken windows. They would use sandwich wrap instead. And old Riyadh was like the Maytag salesman, the loneliest man in town.
And there were fixers who reporters would always go to get things that they need. What did the fixers do?
Well, the fixers basically knew whose palm to grease, when, where, and how to get you whatever you needed. Basically, Beirut was the ultimate duty-free port. There was nothing that you couldn't get in Beirut. You could get a marriage license, you could get a divorce certificate, you could get a driver's license for any country in the world, you could get counterfeit money, you could get a bar mitzvah if you wanted in Beirut, if you could pay for it. The fixer's job was to basically interface between you and the chaos and extract from that chaos whatever you needed, whether it was phony tax receipts or phony taxi receipts, they would do it.
You and your fellow reporters in West Beirut prided yourselves on having lots of contacts and knowing who to talk to. But you say when you got really scared when you saw friends and colleagues getting kidnapped, and you realized it was the people who you didn't know and the people who you could never reach.
Exactly.
Who were the real important characters here.
Well, that was really one of the lessons I learned in Beirut, Terry, is that the people who come around and talk to you, the spokesman, and the people who drink with you at the Commodore Hotel Bar, the famous hotel in Beirut, those aren't the people you have to be afraid of. It's the people who lurk in the silence, the people who live in the shadows, who go out and kidnap other people and then go home and quietly savor it over a Turkish coffee. And one of the things I learned in Beirut was to respect the silence and to recognize how little I had really penetrated the society. I learned that lesson one day in the Commodore Bar right after the Marines had left Beirut and the Shiites took over the city from the Lebanese army. I was sitting in the Commodore having lunch about noon when a Shiite militiaman burst into the hotel, walked across the lobby, and took a M16 rifle in his hands and smashed every single liquor bottle in the bar with the butt of his rifle right before our eyes. The bartender knew he was coming, or knew someone like that might be coming, and had hidden all the bottles of liquor actually under the bar and set up a pyramid of Pepsi cans on top. But this guy wasn't fooled. He ferreted out every bottle and smashed them. And all I could think of when I saw that guy was that, wait a minute, he was my neighbor. I was living next to that guy all this time, and I never really knew he was there. My fault, not his.
Hmm. You were in Beirut for the evacuation of the PLO, and you write that you think the PLO got spoiled in Beirut.
Well, they basically got captivated by Beirut. Beirut is a city of illusions. Every night is 1,001 nights in Beirut. It's a city where men pose, a city of amusement park mirrors that make fat people look thin, tall people look short, short people look tall. You can invent yourself and reinvent yourself any way you like in Beirut, and men did. By simply setting up a checkpoint on a barren stretch of road with two teenagers with pistols tucked into their belts, you could be a general. You could be a liberation movement. You could be a political party. The law of Lebanese politics was, I have a checkpoint, therefore I exist. And the PLO was basically caught up in Beirut's charms. It fancied itself as a great revolutionary movement and cranked out posters and whatnot. But in fact, it turned into a fat, overweight bureaucracy whose officials' rhetoric was as puffed out as their paunches.
Is that how you still see the PLO?
In large part, yes.
Mm-hmm. You also write that you think that the PLO's terrorist acts were relevant, if still morally repugnant, but they were relevant early on when the plight of the Palestinians was being ignored, but you thought that later it just became an end in itself.
Right. I was in no way trying to justify the terrorism of the PLO. I was simply making the point that given the nature of the world in this day and age, they would have been ignored had they not, I think, engaged in these terrorist acts. The problem was that they got addicted to their own headlines. The importance of terrorism for them was that it put them on the world agenda. It forced them, they forced themselves into the headlines and the evening news of the world. But those headlines became a narcotic substitute for real grassroots political action, organization, and hard choices, hard political choices, accepting a compromise with Israel. And they, in fact, got hooked on their own headlines. And when they did, they, I think, got a totally distorted sense of their own real power to shape events. I mean, if the editors of Time magazine are chasing you around the world to get an interview, you, Yasser Arafat, well, then you're going to feel pretty important. You're going to feel that the wind is at your back, the time is on your side. But in fact, it wasn't. It was really an illusion. They confused headlines for heartstrings, really, and attention for sympathy, and it wasn't always there.
Did you ever feel that as a reporter you were doing things that reinforced their glorification in headlines?
Well, inevitably. I mean, when you are there, they are the story. You're caught up with it. You're part of the feeding frenzy. And it's a difficult thing to resist or stand back from when the herd of which you're a part inevitably is charging in that direction.
Shortly before you left Beirut to go to Jerusalem, you were in your apartment, I think this is in the middle of the night, when your house was getting fired on. So you hid out in the bathroom, which was the only room without windows. And your first impulse was, hey, this is news in the making. Let me call my editor at the Times. Then what happened?
Well, the apartment was being mortared, and there I was in the bathroom, sitting on the toilet, listening to the women in the apartment below me wail about how they couldn't take it anymore, and I thought, this indeed is news, and I got down on my knees and crawled into my office and reached up for the telephone and started dialing the New York Times foreign desk in New York, and I got about halfway through the number when I said to myself, what are you doing, you fool? This isn't news. This kind of shelling's been going on for 14 years. It just happens to be your neighborhood tonight, but that doesn't make it news. And then I thought to myself, my God, I'm the New York Times correspondent, and I'm being shelled, and it's not news. It's time to go home.
Is that why you left?
More or less.
When you left Beirut, what you actually did was go to Jerusalem to become the New York Times bureau chief there.
Right.
Do you think you had a different perspective covering Israel, having come from Lebanon?
Definitely. It's actually a very good question, because it's something I don't state explicitly in the book, but it definitely affected, I think, how I covered the West Bank and Gaza Strip. And I was criticized for this by some people, and so I'll say it straight out, in some ways, mea culpa. Having been in Lebanon and experienced so much personal violence, for me, that someone getting his arm broken or shot in the leg by Israeli troops did not send me running. My attitude was that this is a tough neighborhood, and everybody here plays by their own rules, and usually their own rules are no rules. And my attitude towards both Israelis and Palestinians was really the same, which was that to Palestinians I would say, look, you want to go out and launch a war against the Jews? All right, well, that's your business. I'll come out and cover it. You want to go out and make peace with the Jews? Even better. I will come out and cover that. But I'm not going to come listen to you whine. You got to get your act together, take your life into your own hands, and reshape your own future. And the same thing I said to the Israelis when they complained about Palestinians, stoning their cars or whatever. I said, look, you want to do something? I'll come out and cover it, but I'm not going to come listen to you whine, all right? I had enough of that. I got better things to do. There are more interesting stories to cover. Not everyone appreciated that attitude, I'll be the first to admit, but that was how I covered the story.
I want to ask you about an observation that you make about the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. You say that you really can't understand the Intifada unless you understand how deeply Palestinians in the Gaza and the West Bank were co-opted by Israel.
Well, I think this is probably one of the more controversial points of the book, my analysis of the Intifada, but I think... As you just said, I don't think you can understand what the Intifada is about unless you understand that Palestinians had been deeply co-opted economically and politically by the Israeli system. The average Palestinian got up in the morning, put on his Israeli-made jeans, drank his Israeli tnuva milk with his Israeli elite coffee, got into a tender to work inside Israel. He spoke Hebrew during the day. While he was gone, his son used Israeli tambour paint to paint anti-Israeli graffiti on the wall. And when he came home, he got an Israeli lawyer, maybe to appeal to an Israeli judge to get his son out of jail, etc., etc., etc. I think the Intifada represents many things, but first and foremost, what it represents is that the Palestinians, I think, found themselves suddenly torn. Their bodies belonged to Israel, while their minds belonged to the PLO. That is, from the shoulders down, they paid allegiance to Yitzhak Shamir, and from the head up, they paid allegiance to Yasser Arafat. And there was a strain as a result of that. And sooner or later, either their body was going to be adjusted to their mind, or their mind was going to be adjusted to their body. And I think what the Intifada represents, the physical act of throwing a stone or going on strike, was their bodies finally acting like their minds had been telling them.
The impression I walk away with from your book is that you think that neither the Arabs nor the Israelis are really serious about peace yet.
Well, I think that's you've come away with the right impression then, Terry. My attitude is that basically one has to look at the Middle East the same way an obstetrician would look at a couple who come to him and say, "Doc, we've been trying to get pregnant for 40 years. We just can't conceive." And the first thing that obstetrician would do would see if these people are really trying to get pregnant or whether they aren't just saying that while they're in his waiting room and then going home and sleeping in separate bedrooms. And what you have, I think, in the Middle East is quite a bit of that. You have Israelis and Palestinians beckoning America to come over, please help us, be the obstetrician for peace, help deliver a settlement. But the truth is, they say that, but they don't want to get pregnant with each other. They each really want to get pregnant with us. And that's something we have to, I think, be very wary of. We can be the greatest obstetrician for peace, but only when they are really ready to nurture together a settlement. And I don't think we're really at that stage yet.
Why did you end up leaving the Middle East? You were there for a really long time, I should say.
Yeah, I was there for about a decade, and I think that after a while it started to get to me. You start to feel that I've been to this play before, I know how it ends. And I developed 5 rules of journalism while I was in the Middle East that guided me. And I knew once I developed these rules, it was also time to come home. Rule number 1 is if you can't take a joke, you shouldn't have come. Because if you don't have a sense of humor about yourself and people there, and understand that they have a sense of humor, you'll go crazy. I learned that rule from a couple of friends of mine who went up to, in Lebanon actually, to the Shouf Mountains to visit a Druze village, to interview some Druze soldiers there. And they were riding in a taxi. There were 2 American journalists, one from the Dallas Times Herald, Bill Barrett, and one from the Philadelphia Inquirer, Dave Zucchino. And as they were driving into this village, they accidentally drove through a Druze checkpoint without seeing the men who were lounging by the side of the road. And these Druze hopped into a car and chased down their taxi and drove it off the side of the road. And the Druze gunmen scrambled out of their car and surrounded the taxi and stuck their guns into the car. And my 2 friends were quaking inside. And one of the Druze gunmen demanded to see their identity cards. And they showed them their ID cards. And by then, the Druze realized, I suppose, that these men weren't a threat, that they were journalists. And one of the Druze said, "Which one of you is from Dallas?" And my friend Bill Barrett raised his hand, and this guy stuck his gun into the car and pointed it at Barrett and said, "Who shot JR?"
That's a great story.
Anyways, that was rule number 1. Rule number 2 is, in Lebanon, never lead your story on a ceasefire because it'll always be over by the next morning's paper. Rule number 3 is, there are no good guys here. There are only bad guys and civilians. And the minute you start thinking that one side is all white and the other all black, it's time to go home. Rule number 4 is, never take a concession except out of the mouth of the person doing the conceding. That is, if I had a dime for every time someone accepted Israel or recognized Israel on behalf of Yasser Arafat, or a dime for every time someone agreed to talk to the PLO on behalf of Shimon Peres, I would have been a multimillionaire by today. I learned that what people tell you in private is irrelevant. All that counts is what they'll defend in public. And my last rule, I'm afraid that I developed in the last year, was that the Israelis will always win, the Palestinians will always make sure that they never enjoy it, and everything else is just commentary.
What does that mean?
It means that I really don't see the situation changing. I think that the Israelis will always have a superior force to enable them to sustain the status quo. The Palestinians will always have enough energy and anger to make sure the Israelis never enjoy it, are never able to really relax. But neither side will make the fundamental compromises, I think, that would enable a real fundamental change in the situation.
Since January, you've been based in Washington, D.C., covering the State Department and foreign affairs. Does it ever get frustrating for you having to talk to a lot of politicians and probably bureaucrats to get stories now after being in the middle of war zones?
Oh, definitely. I've gone from covering a street to covering a hall, and from covering a drama unfolding before my eyes to covering a policy that's invisible. I mean, mm-hmm. What is a policy? It's a collection of attitudes, grunts and nods and winks. You know, you can't say, I saw the policy today. It bled all over the floor. I saw the policy today. It wept before my eyes. I certainly miss that high drama. At the same time, trying to follow the Middle East from here is very difficult. It's what a friend of mine calls trying to play tennis on a vertical court, because there's the diplomats here, and they have the peace process, and the peace process has its peace processors, and it goes according to its own rules and bizarre logic, but it bears no resemblance or very little resemblance to the reality I know on the land. I mean, tennis is a game that's played on a horizontal court, and that's the game that's going on the land.
Well, Tom Friedman, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. Thank you for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.